Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
Variety is back with its annual Entertainment Marketing Summit on April 24th at the luxurious Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles. This must-attend event for entertainment marketers will feature conversations with leaders from Netflix, Paramount, Activision, Mattel, LA Rams, Google, and more. Plus, an exclusive keynote conversation with Paris Hilton. The networking opportunities are unbeatable. And once you register, you can start chatting with other registrants to plan a meetup at the lunch or cocktail hour. Limited tickets are available, so secure your spot today at events.variety.com.
Welcome to Make It Happen Here, a podcast about it happening somewhere else. The theme of this show has gone slightly off the rails since it was first conceived. However, I do think this is something that is very important to talk about, which is getting some more sort of background information and an understanding of what the history of sort of labor and general protest is in China, as we look at the sort of current protest wave that is going on there. And with me to talk about this is Eli Friedman, who teaches at Cornell University and is the author of the book The Urbanization of People: The Politics of Development, Labor Markets, and Schooling in the Chinese City. So, Eli, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk with you about this, partially because I think... Okay, so insofar as you've gotten sort of mainstream coverage of it, there's been a lot of focus in terms of the sort of current wave of protests. There's been a lot of focus on like the A4 paper stuff and people sort of, you know, hanging signs up. And as the coverage has gone on, there's been a lot less about the Foxconn stuff. There's been a lot less about the broader trajectory of what protest has looked like in China in the last 20 years, as everyone sort of like immediately reaches back for their stock Tiananmen comparisons, which I don't think are very good.
Are wrong.
Yeah. So I guess we could in some sense start with Tiananmen, because I think this is has nothing really to do with it, but I guess we could start with Why are the Tiananmen comparisons bad, and why is everyone still reaching for them 30 years later?
Yeah, I mean, there's maybe a couple of reasons why. So the unsympathetic take on it is that you have a lot of people outside of China, particularly in the United States, who hope for things to go poorly in China,
yeah,
as part of our imperial competition. And yeah, so 1989 was a bad year for China, whichever side of that movement you were on. And so they believe that it heralds, you know, the downfall of the Communist Party, and you know, therefore America can march into the rest of the century without any real competitors. So that is a real thing, right? I think the somewhat more sympathetic take on this is that the Chinese government, and particularly under Xi Jinping, sets a ridiculously high standard for what qualifies as social stability, right? So minor deviations from absolute harmony as conceived of by the state, which means, you know, no street protests. It means relatively little dissent online. And to the extent that you do see forms of collective action, they remain pretty small scale and fractured. And so when you see deviations from that, that suggests that, well, they've kind of lost control because they do want to maintain this, you know, absolute image of placidity. And if we look at the whole sequence of events that led up to where we are now, I think we have to trace it back. Well, there's a bunch of things, but one of them is the Setong bridge protest, which is just a single person hanging banners off a bridge in Beijing. And a single person hanging banners or holding signs in any other big city around the world does not create that kind of a stir, right? I mean, you know, you're in Washington, D.C., or you're in Berlin or Tokyo or whatever, and, you know, nobody cares, right? So that, but that just shows a little bit of a crack in the system. And so then people let their imaginations kind of run wild. And we're clearly not in a 1989 situation right now. It's not inconceivable that it would develop in that way in the future. At the same time, I don't think it's particularly likely for all sorts of reasons. And we can get into that if you want.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think, I don't know, one of the things that I've been looking at with these protests versus 1989, partially it's just the sort of class composition is just very, very different. Like, there are student protests, but it's they're like the students now, like, are not the 1989 students. Like, this is just a very different sort of, like, it's a very different student body. It's a very different, like, the class composition of those people are different. The experience that they've had in the Chinese system is very different. And then also, I think somewhat more interestingly is, like, it's not the same working class that showed up in 1989, because that class doesn't really exist anymore. And yeah, and I guess that's another part of this that I think, I don't know, there is definitely extent to which these protests are weird in that it is like it's a bunch of people in different places who are protesting about the same thing, which hasn't really happened for a long time. But also, like, I don't know, there seems to be this reluctance to talk about the fact that there have been, like, not insignificant protests in the last 30 years, like, especially in the 90s, there are these huge protests against sort of like deindustrialization, like the destruction of sort of the Chinese welfare system. And I guess one of the things I'm interested, I don't know, in asking you more about is, like, there's a kind of trajectory of what urban sort of protest has looked like. And, like, as the sort of, like, as the Chinese working class has, like, increasingly become a sort of migrant working class. And so, yeah, I guess we could jump off from there to also, I guess, because that's the other thing is, like, Chinese cities are very different now than they were 30 years ago, which is a thing that is both incredibly obvious and also, like, people don't really seem to understand very well.
Yeah. Let's see. There's a lot in that question. Maybe we should circle back around to the question of the class composition of the students and the workers today in comparison to 1989. But first, let's just talk a little bit about the sequence of labor protest over the past.
There was a lot of me going through stuff there.
Yeah, I mean, all really important insights. Each deserving a little bit of their own attention. So, you know, after 1989. There's this big divergence in the opportunities that are afforded to the two constituent groups that were in Tiananmen Square and other places around China. So you have the students and you have the workers, right? And there's other people, but, like, that's the social backbone of that movement. The students basically get this deal with the state, which is they demand compliance and political acquiescence in exchange for which they will enjoy a couple of decades of unbelievably fast growth. And if you are graduating with a degree from one of these elite universities in Beijing, or even not super elite universities in other cities, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to experience upward social mobility, that you'll be able to buy an apartment, that, you know, you will feel more materially secure than was the case for your parents, right? I think that deal is coming undone right now, which in part explains the students that we see out in the street. But in any event, that certainly was the case for about 30 years after, or at least, you know, 25 years after Tiananmen. The workers who were in the square in 1989 had a almost diametrically opposed social trajectory, because immediately thereafter, They were subjected to a brutal regime of privatization, of dispossession, of theft of public property. They were thrown out of these jobs that they had believed they were going to have forever. It was called the Iron Rice Bowl. One of the main architects of that was Jiang Zemin, who's just died. He, along with Zhu Rongji.
I saw a great quote where someone was like, this is basically China's George W. Bush, where everyone's remembering him fondly because things are so bad now. But oh my God, this guy was awful. Like, dying right now is maybe the best thing he ever did. Like, it's, oh God.
And it really is a testament to how bad things are now. But he is, I think, the most neoliberal anyway of China's leaders, more so than Deng Xiaoping in some important ways. And so, you know, that old working class who was told that they were the masters of the nation, you know, under Jiang Zemin in the late 90s, they were just subjected to these real subsistence crises. And in response to that, actually, the largest mobilizations to have happened since 1989 occurred in the late 90s and really the early 2000s. In some cases, you had these protest movements with many tens of thousands of people out in the street resisting privatization, resisting the theft of their pensions, and basically this, you know, private profiteering and theft of public property. And I think that even the protests that we've seen in the last week or two are still not on the scale of those worker uprisings that we saw 20 years ago.
Yeah, which I guess, you know, like part of the reason why we are where we are now is that those people lost. And I think that's been one of the other sort of themes of like Chinese protests is like, I mean, I think like some of the local ones like win, but the large scale ones have kind of just been like, really just been getting owned for the last like 20, really like 30 years. Like it's been kind of a bleak march. And I mean, I want to circle back around a bit, talk a bit more about the deindustrialization, because I think this is a thing that like really is badly understood, especially on the left. The other thing I wanted to talk about in that is, okay, so you have this massive wave of privatization, you have this deindustrialization. And can we talk a little bit also about how, like, for the people who held on in state-owned industries, what the sort of transformations that happened inside there was like? Because I think that's also like not understood well.
Yeah. So you have two processes. One is they talk about it as smashing the Iron Rice Bowl, right? And that involves two processes. One is just unemployment. And there's been a lot of efforts to try to estimate how many people lost their jobs. It is very hard. A political scientist named Dorothy Salinger wrote an article called Why It's Impossible to Know How Many Unemployed People There Are, or something to that effect. But certainly tens of millions of people lost their jobs and were just kind of thrown out into the market. And it's worth remembering that they were thrown out into the market largely in regions where the market was not at all dynamic, right? So in the northeastern part of the country, which did not have the booming economy of Guangdong province or, you know, Jiangsu province or places like that. So there were those people. You know, people also probably know that there are still a lot of state-owned enterprises, and something like a quarter to, you know, maybe a third of China's economy is still accounted for by state-owned enterprises. But those enterprises have increasingly come to function like capitalist enterprises, at least with respect to labor relations. They still receive a lot of subsidies from the state. They still enjoy monopolies, right? So that, you know, they don't face competition from other firms, at least domestically. And like monopoly-based firms in capitalist countries, they offer somewhat better pay and somewhat better benefits to their core workforce, right? So, I mean, if you think of GM or Ford in the middle of the 20th century in the United States, or you can think about Facebook or Google today, you know, these companies that are also basically enjoy monopoly position, their core workers enjoy, you know, somewhat better pay, right? But the other thing that's happened is they have increasingly come to be surrounded by a very large contingent of temporary and flexible workers, right? And so in many of these state-owned firms, more than 50% of the employees are what they call in China dispatch workers, right? They don't enjoy any of those same benefits. They don't enjoy the same job stabilities. And they, in response to market fluctuations and profitability, those are always the first ones to be let go, right? So, you know, the fact that they are state-owned, I think, matters to some extent. But it doesn't mean that the old labor regime from, you know, the 1970s has kind of continued unchanged. Like these firms are being subjected to market pressures, and that's reflected in how they treat labor.
Yeah, and I mean that's something that like if you listen to Xi Jinping like actually talk about what's going on, he just constantly every like two speeches that he gives, there is a line about how like the economy is directed by the market and like
He's very clear about it. And yeah. In some ways he's like very Reaganite. Like he's just like we don't want to let these lazy people just enjoy welfare benefits. Like they believe in the power of the market to discipline people. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and I guess the other sort of consequence of this is China's enormous migrant worker population. And that's another thing I wanted to talk about, because that was another round of protests that happens in the 2000s that's about this giant fight over household registration that I guess was the last kind of successful, like really mass protest thing in China. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, there haven't been the same scale of collective protests by migrant workers, but you know, just as a little bit of background, you have the old state-owned working class is kind of declining or subjected to the market pressures that we're talking about, and so unrest in that sector becomes a little bit less significant over the course of the 2000s, but that's happening at precisely the same time that the working class in the private firms is increasingly constituted by these rural to urban migrant workers. When they come to the cities, they are treated essentially as second-class citizens and don't have guaranteed access to all kinds of social services, healthcare, pensions, education, et cetera. And so there is a lot of mobilization. I mean, you know, the hukou household system, household registration system still exists, and it still has an important role in structuring people's classed experiences. But it's a little bit less coercive than it used to be. So in 2003, there was this famous case, a migrant named Sun Zhigang. Was taken into custody, as frequently happened, you know, at the time, like police would just ask people for their papers on the street if they looked suspicious. And they had a thing in place at the time called custody and repatriation, where they would take you into custody and they would repatriate you back to your village, right? Yeah. So very similar, you know, to like ICE raids.
Yeah.
But against Chinese people.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they had, you know, this is, I think, one of the things about, like, insofar as you can make comparisons between like the Chinese system and the Soviet system, is like that's one of the few things that was, I think, kind of similar, is that you do have these very intense simultaneously you have these very intense like internal restrictions on migration, but also very similar to the US system. It's like the economy is based on everyone breaking these things. That's but right. Simultaneously it's illegal.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, there's no illegal immigration to the United States, but the economy would obviously collapse without undocumented workers. And it's exactly the same in China. Like, you know, they're like, we know that these people are here. We know that our economy, particularly in the coastal cities, is completely dependent on them, but we're still going to have cops ask you for your papers on the street. And if they don't like you, they can, you know, round you up and send you home. In this particular case, back in 2003, the guy they got, it's like he was the quote unquote wrong guy, because he was actually a university student, and they detained him and killed him. And so when this came out and they're like, oh, they killed a college student. Like had they killed a normal migrant worker, that'd be one thing. But he's a college student. So that created a big fuss. And as a result, you know, they actually got rid of detention and repatriation, which is good. And so migrant workers today, when they're on the streets in the big cities, are not likely to, you know, just have cops randomly ask them to see their papers, but they're still subjected to all kinds of social discrimination and definitely, you know, institutional discrimination.
Yeah. So, okay. Speaking of institutional discrimination, we're going to take an ad break and then we will come back and talk more about this. So enjoy some ads from companies who are probably benefiting from all of this.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
And we're back. So, okay, that's another thing that I do want to sort of, I guess, use this to push us forward a little bit, which is that, okay, this is obviously skipping a lot of riots in 2011, but one of the big things about the COVID restrictions that I don't think people understand has been how bad it's been affecting American workers and the extent to which, you know, because one of the things about the household registration system is, like, as best I can tell, this is the way a lot of resources in terms of, like, here's how you're getting food have been being distributed. And if you're in a place that's not where your household registration is, it's like, well, OK, the state's not giving you your food. How are you going to deal with this stuff?
They're not telling you
that's been a big thing that, like, I don't know. But a lot of this has been me being upset with the media coverage of these protests, because, like, people will just say COVID zero and then not explain what the actual consequences of this are. So, yeah, I was wondering if we could talk about sort of specifically how the lockdowns, especially as lockdowns have gone on, have been affecting migrant workers, and then how that's okay. So we'll start there before I jump into a question with 700 parts.
I do think it's really important to understand why people are opposed to zero COVID. And sometimes for people outside of China, they think back to the spring of 2020 when, you know, in the United States, we had, like, libertarians with guns being like, in the lockdown, like, we want our freedom. Like, it is not that, for all sorts of reasons. And the way to get at why it's different is to understand some of the classed differences that zero COVID has entailed. And I should just say it's been pretty terrible for everybody, including rich people. And, like, you know, we can feel some sympathy for them too. But it's had some particularly nefarious consequences for migrant workers. This became really clear in the Shanghai lockdown. It's also worth noting that there are 300 million migrant workers in China. Like, so this is not like a rounding error or anything.
This is like half the population of Europe. Like, that's how many people we're talking about here. It's absurd. Yeah,
it's almost an America-sized population of people who are not living where their household registration is. And so the basic thing is, as you were just sort of saying, that when there is a lockdown and you're a migrant worker, you kind of don't exist from the states, or you might exist, but, like, you might also be overlooked from the perspective of the state. So one very concrete way that this screwed people over was in these hard lockdowns, you're not allowed out of your house and you're dependent on the neighborhood committee, which is connected to the state. It's kind of the lowest level of the state. You were dependent on them for the delivery of everything that you need to survive, right? Critically, food and medicine.
Yeah, I want to back up and say something about this. Yeah. This is something very, very different than the American lockdowns, which is, like, it depends on a province by province basis. Like, I know my family was in Inner Mongolia. They, like, in Inner Mongolia, like, the lockdown isn't like you don't go to work. The lockdown is you cannot leave your house. Like, you can. I think their lockdown, their first one, was one person in their house once a week can leave to go get groceries. But it's like, it's not like, yeah, like it's you, like, you physically cannot leave. You will be, if you attempt to leave, you will be prevented from doing so. And this means that you don't really have an independent way of, like, getting food or, like, going shopping or
that's right.
Yeah. Like, getting, I don't know, like, toilet paper, like,
Yeah, no, toilet paper. I mean, that resonates with Americans and our toilet paper shortage of 2020. But I mean, in some cases, like, people would actually just be literally chained into their apartments, right? So, like, this is not whatever people in the U.S. or even in parts of Western Europe, you know, where the lockdowns were a little bit more intensely policed. Like, it is not that. It is a qualitatively different thing, and so. Yeah, you're completely dependent on the state. So therefore, it's really, really important that the state know that you are there and that the state feels itself to be tasked with your survival. And if you're a migrant worker, so one of the very concrete ways that this affected migrant workers is that a lot of them live in informal housing, even in the biggest cities, even in places like Shanghai and Beijing, because those are the only places that they can live. As far as the state's concerned, like, that informal housing might not exist. There are very, very frequently more people living in those dwellings than are sort of legally accounted for. So, you know, like, there's 10 people living in an apartment that's supposed to be for, you know, a family of three. And so they deliver three people's worth of food, but there's actually 10 people living there. That's a subsistence crisis, right? You know, the medical stuff is just astonishing and very harrowing. I mean, you know, just people just dying in their apartment because, like, they can't get insulin or all kinds of other things.
I know people whose family died because they had cancer and they couldn't get treatment for it because.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's a disaster.
Yeah. So that's the situation. That's one of the problems for the migrant workers. And then in the very intense lockdowns, at least in Shanghai back in the spring of this year. You know, they also can't leave. So, like, one option would be like, okay, well, you go back to the place where you do have your household registration, you know, back in the village, and you have a piece of land and, like, you can survive. They couldn't leave, right? There's no transportation. And so they were trapped in this situation where they couldn't work. The government wasn't, delivering them food, and they couldn't go to some other place where they could get food. And so, you know, there's been a lot of attention to these recent protests, which are extremely important and qualitatively different. But even back in April 2020, we saw food riots. Like, in Shanghai, a group of migrant workers just, like, requisitioned like a truck full of cabbage, you know, and just started, like, tossing cabbages to people on the street because people were like, literally starving. So, I mean, yeah. So it's a real problem for the migrant workers.
And on that note, this has been Naked Appen here. Join us tomorrow for part two of this episode, where we'll be talking more about lockdowns, some more problems with migrant workers, and this all going.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.